Alzheimer's also on Monday, because of it being Morris. He's taken ill. He's still coming, but he's coming a day late. So the course will begin on Tuesday through Friday. He will reconfigure his lectures, 5 lectures into 4. It means all of you will have to receive one day's refund. This is, as you can understand, with over 300 people, complicated for us to arrange short notice. And so we'll only be able to give you those refunds from Wednesday next week, from Wednesday through Friday. So if you could all just remember that's not opening on Monday, it's opening on Tuesday, same time, and you will get a refund depending on whether you pay full fees or student fees, it's obvious. I can't hear you. The course is 5 lectures, it's going to be 4 lectures. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, excluding the Monday, which is when it's starting. Okay, sorry to bear over the news, we have to fly a day later. Stephen Quill will come on the Monday and give an extra lecture.
William Butler Yeats, who is certainly one of the greatest, not only one of the greatest writers of the late 19th, early 20th century, I think one of the greatest poets in English. And this obscure person, John Millington Synge. When plays were performed at the Abbey Theatre, Lady Augusta Gregory, let's get interval at the end, would walk around very elegantly and say, "Did you enjoy the play? I'm so glad. It's wonderful to see you again. Oh, hello, this is marvelous that you're supporting us. Would you like to show me?" William Butler Yeats would stand in the middle of wherever there was a little to stand on, and he would expound on the play. It was brilliant because of this, the actors did that, it has reference to the other, and people throng around him. John Millington Synge would stand in the corner watching everybody. Why is that important? Because he wanted to hear what people were saying and what the turn of phrase was. And he did that in his travel writings as well. For instance, when he cycled about Wicklow, West Kerry, and Connemara, for instance, he would get to a tavern at night, and he would lie with his ear to the floor of his room and listen to the wooden slats to listen to what the chambermaids or the cook or the dishwashers or whatever were saying. Not for the sake of gossip, but to hear their turn of phrase. So he could translate that into his place. You've got it in front of you, Yeats, in memory of Major Robert Gregory. This was written in memory of this incredibly brave, wonderful man, Lady Augusta Gregory's son, who was killed in the First World War. Again, an Irish airman foresees his death. "I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere among the clouds above. Those I faint quite I do not hate, those I guard I do not love." You know that? That was the Irish end of Sir Robert Gregory. And in the poem, Yeats says, "And that inquiring man, John Synge, comes next, that dying chose a little world for text." Synge wrote about real people in bizarre situations. But people who see now in the Municipal Gallery revisited, Yeats writes, "John Synge, I, and Augusta Gregory thought all that we did, all that we said or sang, must come from contact with the soil. From that contact, everything and tears like grew strong, and tears as you remember, got all his strength from the earth, and as long as he was in contact with the earth, he could not be defeated." And Synge in particular, his contact was from the earth, from Ireland itself. We three alone in modern times have brought everything down to that soul test again. Dream of the noble and the beggar man. So you might ask, yes, Synge was Irish, and a lot of you have read him, a lot of you haven't, a lot of you haven't heard of him. And you say, what about other Irish writers? What about the hilarious Richard Brinsley Butler, Sheridan, whose most famous plays, The Rivals and The School of Scandal? Yes, they're wonderful plays, they're hysterical. What about that brilliant, wonderful Oscar? The Importance of Being Earnest, the famous one. What about him? What about George Bernard, Arms and the Man, etc.? very, very funny. Why is he? Didn't write as many, not as well known. Because, as I explained to you soon, Singh wrote a play, which apart from being hysterically funny, Devi, apart from that, actually has had such an incredible influence on theatre, especially in the English-speaking world, possibly more than any play in the last 100 years. That's all. So, I'm only going to concentrate on the comedies. I am not then going to say anything very much about Riders to the Sea, regarded as the greatest one-act tragedy in English. I am not going to say anything about Deirdre of the Sorrows, which is an amazing, amazing three-act tragedy with the most beautiful, beautiful language worthy of Shakespeare, and if you think that's an exaggeration, it's not. I'm not going to say anything about The Tinker's Wedding, which is a comedy, but I don't like it. I'm going to talk about three of these other plays. First of all, as I said in your notes you have, the first one, this is not in front of you, The Shadow of the Glen. Now, Singh had written Riders to the Sea, and he was acclaimed for this incredible tragedy. Came along The Shadow of the Glen, and it's a comedy. It opens with a woman, Nora Byrne, alone in a house, in a valley, a cottage in Ireland, watching over the body of her dead husband. I said this was a comedy. And she is sitting there, obviously quite irritated about having to sit watching, you know, the Irish, you know, how I go the way. And a knock on the door and a trap. And she lets him in. You do that sort of thing, right? She lets him in. And he walks and says, oh. And this, you know, this is my late husband. And he says, it's a queer look of my kid, isn't it? For a man that's dead. She said he had a queer look of money when he was alive, what do you expect me to say? And she said to him, do me a favor, I have things to do. I can't just sit here all night looking after the corpse of my husband. Could you please just sit here and watch over him? And the tramp says, well, I don't mind if I do. She goes off, and the tramp starts sewing up his clothes. And he's sewing up his clothes, and he looks, and the corpse starts sitting up. For some obscure reason, the tramp gets a fright. And the corpse says to him, don't be ridiculous. Give me a wee dram. And the tramp says, that's Scottish, not Irish. And he asks for a drink. And he says, well, what's going on here? And the corpse and says, well, I'm not really dead. And the tramp is good. And he says, well, really, I don't trust my wife. I think she's dallying with a young man. And the tramp is not surprised. And so he says, give me a drink. I want to catch her out. It's a wild place. I'll be good at that. They hear people talking outside, and the tramp says, you're going to lie down again. The man lies down again, becomes a corpse. And Nora comes in with this handsome young hunk of a man. Let me tell you, Nora is young, about 20-ish. The young man is young. about 50. The husband is old, about... Okay. Now, and they start talking about what they're going to do after the funeral, how they're going to get married, and how they're going to run the farm, and they go on and on. It's evident they've been dallying for quite some time. At which point, the corpse is up the second time. Nora and Michael, the love of Michael, get a bit of fright, the transducer by mistake. And the husband, Daniel, says, "So, you've been betraying me," and what happens, obviously, he kicks out Nora with the trap, and he and Michael sit around the table and have a drink together. That is very much an Irishism, doesn't make sense, but it's actually what happens. Well, when a play was performed, there was an uproar. How dare Sim write this? How dare he imply that Irish women are ever unfaithful to their husbands? At that stage, the writing, the plays, they were stereotypical characters. Irishmen were generally hale, hearty, and drunk. The women were in the background, but usually quite outspoken, or the barmaid type, whatever that might be. Here he has a married couple with a woman betraying her husband. This can never, ever happen. So it was a scandal. Sing, of course, is right. We must remember that at that time in Ireland, a man had a farm. He had children. Girls were very important then. The eldest would inherit the farm. Number two would probably go off to America. Number three would probably go off to England. Number four would probably become a priest. Number five would probably become a priest. Number six would be so, eldest son grew up with mommy and especially daddy. But he couldn't afford to get married, get no property, he had no money. He had to wait for daddy to die. And daddy sometimes took his time about doing it. So when the son inherited the farm, he could be in his 40s or more, and he'd be looking around for a woman to go forward and multiply. He obviously wouldn't look for a woman of his own age, he'd look for somebody who could give him 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 children, whatever. And so he'd go for a girl in her late teens or very early 20s. Her parents would say yes, because they're just too glad to have her off their hands. And then he obviously, let's say, wouldn't be her adonis, her dream guy. And she, of course, would be friendly with some young men who had no prospects. Okay. So this is accurate, but it caused an absolute furore. The other one I want to talk briefly about is the Well of the Saints. And this alone could have a lecture to itself. You haven't got it in front of you. In short, two blind people, elderly, Martin and Mary Dool, blind, are living in their cage. They don't work. They tell each other how beautiful they are. Mary says, "Oh, you're such a beautiful woman. Everyone comes around and tells me I'm beautiful." And Mary, and Martin says, "What about me? I'm such a strong and hale and vigorous and handsome man. Oh, the girl," etc., etc., etc. And then, in the distance, they hear tinkle, tinkle, tinkle. A saint is coming along with his bell and holy water. And as you all know, if a saint sprinkles holy water on you, you are cleared of or purged of all your afflictions. So the village people are terribly excited, and they say to the blind couple, come on out of your head, come on, you're going to be able to see again. And they are really excited. Martin can't wait to see his wife, he knows it's so beautiful. And the saint comes and sprinkles the water, the holy water, on Martin's eyes. And he opens his eyes and he sees next to him the most beautiful girl imaginable. An Irish, Catherine Zeta-Jones. And he walks towards her, oh Mary, my darling, so it's true what you are telling me. And she hits him across the face and says, I am not. I'm Molly Byrne, that's your wife. And turns around and there's this ugly old hag. And he wants to hit her. They fight, because he's equally appalling. And they go off. Action. They both have to work for a living. They hate seeing who's not in the world. People aren't good to them anymore. Okay, they're not enjoying this. Act 3. The two of them are squatting in the hedge, telling each other how ugly they are and how they detest each other. And, but in time, their sight goes again. Because, as you know, when you have holy water sprinkled on you, it only works for a little while. And now they become absolutely blind, they're back in their hedge. And they are getting used to being blind again because people bring them food, people look after them, tinkle, 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 they're saying something like more holy water. And as you know, the second time they get holy water sprinkled on you, you're cured forever. So they drag you out of the water and say, we don't want to be cured. We don't want to see again. And the saint says, you must see, and the religious say, you must see, it is God's will. And Martin says, okay. And he walks to the saint with Mary by his side. And he says, could I just feel the vial in which the holy water is? And the saint says, yes, of course. And he takes it, and he flings it to the ground. Everything breaks, the water is lost. And Martin says, one of my favorite lines in literature, may the Lord protect us from the saints of God. And again, an Irishism, something that doesn't quite make sense. Okay. So, at the end, the two of them are in the hedge again, they're happily blind, and Martin says, oh, good enough to throw a blind. I saw that my beard was growing so white, I looked so good, I was so handsome, everyone's going to come around and see me. And she says, well, what about me before I am blind again? I saw a reflection in the glass, my hair is turning absolutely white, I shall be the toast of the seven kingdoms, etc., etc., etc. And they live happily and blindly ever after. Now we know what sin is about. Which brings us to the greatest of the plays, the Playboy of the Western world. You might be interested to know that this week is exactly 107 years since Synge wrote the preface to it on the 21st of January 1907, and was first performed on the 26th of January 1907. Here comes the personal anecdote. So is this bouncing back a lot or not? I grew up and I occasionally heard my two grandmothers saying things in different countries they were, but saying things such as, oh, it's a scandal as big as a Playboy. Or, isn't Playboy of the Western world the most terrible play? Oh, the scandal around it. Have you ever seen it? know, and I know all about it because when I was a girl, that's what everyone was talking about, the scandal of the Playboy, the scandal of the Playboy. And I didn't know what the Playboy was, except play. I didn't know it was why it was a scandal. And also, I was too young to read it, obviously. However, when I got to high school, one day there was a big buzz around my school friends because one of them had managed to swipe a copy of Playboy from his elder brother. As a Playboy, it was banned then. And they were all terribly excited, so at break, we all thronged around, and the boys were oohing and aahing about these big-breasted women, and they were all terribly excited. And I was disappointed, I thought it was a play. So, what does Playboy mean? It means a hoaxer, somebody who fools other people. It also means one who is played with. Now, in this play, you'll see it, a hoaxer, the playboy here, Christy Mann, fools everybody about his story. But they play with him, they load him up as well, they mean that as well. One who is a player, one who is a sportsman, one who is good at physical activity, which he proves himself to be, and one who is full of his play spirit. One who learns how to enjoy himself. That is what Playboy means for all of these things. You'll see the names here, Christy Mann, you've got that in front of you, haven't you? Yes? Christy Mann is the main character. Old Mann is his father. Begin Mike, whose real name is Margaret Flaherty. Begin is the diminutive of Margaret as Meg, Maggie, Peg, Peggy. This is Begin Mike. Mike meaning the father's Michael. Who's Michael Flaherty, the brilliant, wonderful, marvellous, fantastic, delightful widow, Quinn. And my wife knows I've been in love with widow Quinn for years, she doesn't mind. And Begin's fiancé, the absolutely wimpish but wealthy Sean Kale. So, there was a rumour in 1907 that one of Sting's plays was going to be performed, and it was going to be a scandalous play. People had seen it, some of the actors had mentioned it, some of the backstage people had mentioned it, and they knew it was going to be vile. It was going to be terrible. It was going to be scandalous, because it was written by this man who used to go around and put his ear to the floor of taverns and spy on the innocent Irish girls. The play opened and people started booing and crying out loud and screaming and swearing because of what was being depicted. And then, Christy says the following line. You got it there. It's Peggy I'm seeking only. And what should I care if you brought me a drift of chosen females, standing in their ships itself maybe, from this place to the eastern world, and a riot broke out. Why did the riot break out? Because he referred to the chosen females as a drift. You get a drift, a collection of cows. He was implying that these girls were cows, and they wonder what cows are. And they started hissing incredibly there. And when he said, standing in their ships, they were scandalized, because a ship is a chemise, it's a woman's undergarment, I suppose, like a petticoat, but that word was never heard in mixed company. And they started screaming things such as, "Take down the bloody goddamn curtain, we can't take this bloody blasphemous language," etc. And they eventually, at three, had to be performed in dumb play because there was such a noise. And people were beating each other up. Nothing could be heard. Now, you've heard, of course, of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, which, when it was performed at Paris Opera a long time ago as well, and that was called such a riot, but it showed a development in music and in performance, physical ballets. This play, Pedro Westwood, after that, people started writing much more naturally and describing people really as how they are. So it has had a great influence on the movement as any play in English, the movement of theatre. And remember when O Calcutta came out? Far greater influence in O Calcutta. Because remember, a ship is more daring than nudity. Well, so they were rioting. The next day, the next evening before the play was due, there was a meeting in the City Hall of Dublin to discuss and to talk about and to condemn this disgusting play. W.B. Yeats was in Scotland. He heard about what happened. He came across to Dublin immediately. And people, it was packed. The City Hall of Dublin was packed to condemn the play. And they knew that the great W.B. Yeats, who was revered throughout Ireland, he was going to address them. And he got up, and people cheered. And he looked at them. He was a friend of Singh, remember. He looked at them and he said, "This Isle of Saints." And everyone cheered, and they hooted and they jumped up. That's us. He calmed it down and he started, "This Isle of Saints, blast the saints." And then they rioted again. The riot carried on throughout the streets of Dublin the whole night. It was quite incredible. It was a cause célèbre. It was a scandal. But you know what that's about. No. So, before we get on to what we've got in front of you, Christy, people are sitting in this shebeen. By the word shebeen, tavern, drinking house, shebeen is an Irish word originally. Okay. Didn't know you have so many Irish people in South Africa. They are, Begin is there with her fiancé, Sean, in this shebeen, and her father and all the friends, his friends. And Michael Flaherty and his friends want to go off to a wake in a neighbouring village. And Begin said, "How can you leave me here alone with all these criminals about?" And Michael, the father, says, "But you've got Sean to look after you." And Sean says, "Oh no, what will Father Riley say? He can't be tempted." We know already that Sean has as much sex drive as a eunuch. And a copy that cannot stay up. And then the door opens, and a small guy about 20, 21 walks in. Says, "God bless all who are here." And they look at him. And they say, "You too." And he says, "Is it safe here?" "Yeah." "Are there peelers about?" "Peelers? Policemen?" "No." "Have you committed a crime?" And he looks at them. He is accused of robbing and stealing. He says, no, he comes from a good family. He would never have done anything illegal like robbing and stealing. They say, well, do you follow a young woman on a lonesome night? He said, no, I've always been a decent lad. And they say, so what did you do? He says, oh, I killed my father. And they're off the room. And they say, would you be prepared to stay here, Michael says, with my daughter Piggy in, and look after her? And he says, yes. And Shaw says, what will Father Ryan say? And everyone says, shut up. Because it solves the problem. The men are free to go to the funeral, to the wake. Shaun doesn't have to be tempted. And he knows the murderer within, Christie, can protect her from the murderers without. So she's absolutely safe. Again, an Irishism, right? Something that doesn't quite make sense. And you are safe for a murder with you, then you didn't have a murder with you at all. Okay, and then the widow Quinn arrives after everyone else has lost, has left, apart from beginning Christy. She arrives and she looks at him and says, basically, she wants to take him home with her and arrest him in front of you. The widow Quinn looks at him with half of his curiosity. Well, aren't you a little smiling fellow? Same as to a murderer. So immediately he's put down again. He's not this brave man. She sees him what he is, a little smiling fellow. And you're going to see the reverses throughout the play the whole time. As soon as he's born, he pulls himself up, pow, comes down again. And then you particularly say your catechism, then slay your dad after that. We'll be walking through. And you'll find we're great company, young fellow. Obviously, she's interested in him for other reasons. When it's of the life of you and me, you hear the penny poet singing in August there. So, he says, did you kill your father? Because that would be a recommendation. There's so much in common there. Okay, and then we have the start of a flighting match. Now, flighting match is F-L-Y-T-I-N-G, which is really an exchange of insults between women, really, and Pegin is vicious over here. She did not. She hit himself with a wand. Pick himself means her husband. She hit her husband. She hit herself with a wand pick, and the rusted poison in her robe is blood away. He never owned it and died after. So, in other words, it wasn't such a thing. That was a sneaky kind of murder. It was small glory in the boys itself. Okay, so, what kind of murder was it? To murder someone with garbage. Doesn't the world know? The widow Quinn, you reared a black ram at your own breast, so that the Lord Bishop of Connacht felt the elements of a Christian, and he eating it after in a kidney stew. So, here we have the mockery of the widow Quinn. Show how sexually frustrated she might well be, and also mocking the bishop really there. And he felt the elements of a Christian. Doesn't the world know? You've been seen shaving a foxy skipper from France for a floppy bit and a stalk of grass to have caught in the liver from mountain looking at the hills, leaping, jumping, leaping. So shaving a foxy skipper from France. We all know skipper, sea captain. We all know what sailors are like, don't we? I'm quite worried about what he was with it, yes. And from France, we all know what Frenchmen are like, don't answer. What happened is this. In other words, she's saying the widow of Queen is her. A what? What should I do? Okay. Yeah, she's a whore, she's a slut, she is loose. But, of course, by Pekin saying this, she does make the widow Queen appear even more appealing to an innocent boy blind. She's experienced. Okay? So, then we've got Christie. I'm obviously not doing a whole play, I'm just taking certain things. Christie explains how he has killed his father. You must note how he gets more confident as time goes on. He embellishes amplification, amplificatio. He exaggerates, but as he embellishes and exaggerates, he gets more lyrical. He speaks more beautifully. And this leads to amusement and also his attractions. It starts like this. I killed my poor father. I never use weapons. I have no license. And I'm a law-fearing man. Okay. Right. There are no weapons. He killed him. It seems it must be an accident. But later, I just risen the boy. I just picked up the spade. I just risen the boy. And then all the effort on the ridge of his skull. Okay. Next one. It was a bitter night in there, which I did half his skull. That's a bit later. So, from killing, probably accidental killing, to just hit him on the head, now his half his skull. And then, a whole lot of girls come around to listen. They heard about this wonderful murder there. They want to meet this murderer. It's terribly exciting. And Christy then embellishes. She took it for the life of you, says he. And come on now, I'll flush you out like a trolley piece of cloth and a dray, a cart. You will not if I can help it, says I. Go on, says he. Or have the devil making doubts of your names tonight. You will not if I can help it. Says I. Now look at the lyricism. For that, the sun came up between the cloud and the hill, and a shining green on my face. God have mercy on your soul, says he, lifting a sigh. Or on your own, says I, raising the lawyer. And what is the reaction? Not, oh my gosh, you are here. Oh my gosh, I'm terrible for you. Oh my gosh, I'm terrified of you. Oh my gosh, you know, you are really the man. You're so strong. What is the action? Susan says, oh, that's a grand story. And on earth, he tells it lovely. In other words, the storytelling is the most important. I know quite a few of you have been to Blarney Castle in Ireland. The stories are really important. Am I right? Yes. Okay. It's a wonderful story, and of course, I say that, they put it down a bit. It also sounds a bit like, who else tells such wonderful stories? Chanticleer. Okay. And we know what happens with men who tell wonderful stories. Okay. It also underlines the monotony of rural areas. That this is the highlight of the decade. Now, Christie is confident, and he waves a chicken bone. He gives a dry with a sun, and I make a left and jump to the east. Then I turn and run with my back to the north. It's very detailed now. And I hit a blow on the ridge on his skull, laying him stretched out, and he slipped to the knob of his gullet. That book is hard on the skull, it's to the gullet. Wow, what a hit. He raised a chin over his saddle capo. Oh, and you're the marvel! Oh, God bless you! God bless you for killing your father. God bless you. the Lord God said in this role to the Lord God, basically, was behind him in his kingdom of the Father, very Christian. And then the Lord God said in this role to make a second husband to the widow and queen. And she had a great yearning, she wedded, as we found out. The old widow here, as we know, lift him on her knee, Sarah Clancy. Here's the boy. They are praising where he killed his father, and again, he thinks he's a man. Lift him on his knee. Lift him on her knee. In other words, he's a little boy, and he's put down again like that. And the widow Quinn's response is, don't. Now, the widow Quinn, I suppose I should tell you this. Please understand, I'm not related to her. It is Quinn and not Finn. And my wife's name is Louis Marcus, and widow Quinn's husband's name was Marcus Quinn. Nothing to do with that. Then he's always called her aggressio and aggression. And then, a bit later, we have this. Chris is saying, oh, how old is the widow Quinn, by the way? About how old you push her? I heard 35? Hey? Early 20s. Yes, you're right, she's in her early 20s. From this out, I don't know what the company with all sorts of bringing in their food and clothing. The way they set their eyes upon a gallant heart and kept his heart with one bow to the breeches belt. Right, the breeches belt now. And now we have, it gets more and more exaggerated. And he's alone now, his nation, okay? He's alone with the widow Quinn. And he's talking about how fantastic he is. He brings his own story. Open the door, stand his back, and says, "Saints of God, before the angels of the throne of light." He says, "What ails you?" "It's a rocking spirit of my murdered dad. His dead father's walking towards them." That's important that the widow Quinn is with him. Because had it been Peggy Mike, she would have sent him packing immediately as a lie that she. They hadn't killed his father. Had it been the girls, they would have laughed at everybody. Had it been the men, they would have mocked him. Had it been Sean Kayo, he would have seen the opportunity of telling everybody and winning, picking back. But it's the widow Quinn who thinks, if I can protect him, I can get something from him. If he marries Peggy, then he's going to be in charge and he's going to be giving me some land or some money to keep my mouth shut. And if he drops him, he'll marry me then. Okay. So he says, she says, isn't that camper? He says, well, I hate my providing the ghost of hell. The doors push open, and the widow Quinn says, God save me, my poor man. Did you see a young lad pass his way out of money on the quiet night? You're a queer kind to walk in, not saluting at all. She doesn't lie. She doesn't say yes. She doesn't say no. Because she's an honest woman. She doesn't lie. But of course, this adds to the tension. Because Christy doesn't know what she's going to do. Did you see the young lad? What time was he? And how many of us feel the love fall on him? A little switch in his hand. It was my own son hit me, and he, a dirty, stuttering lout. He wasn't killed after all, as you see. Remember the Nansky's tale, Chanticleer says, murder will out? Here we've got the lack of murder will out. Well, we're going to hurry this along. Later on, everyone's around. The playboy Christy is taking part in the sports below. And there's a big, big noise going on, and he's winning everything. And he's winning everything, of course, because the men of the town are generally half-blind, certainly deaf, half-crippled, half-lame, so he can win everything. And old Marlister, who it is, and why are they roaring the low? And she says, with a shade of a smile, they're cheering a young lad, the champion playboy of the Western world. That's where it comes from. Later on, Christie's alone with Begin, and he speaks beautifully to her. And just skip a few, about 5 lines, he says, "Let you wait to hear me talking to me of strange errors, when good Friday's by, drinking a sup from a well, and making mighty kisses with our wicked mouths, or gaining the apple sunshine with itself stretched back into your necklace in the flowers of the earth. It's lyrical, it's beautiful, he's telling the story." And as he's starting to succumb to his beautiful, lyrical storytelling, we hear Michael returning, joining around the tourney. They quickly ran us down and brought us back as prisoners once more to Covent Town. He's drunk, the moon is broken. Again, Christie realizes, well, Christie can't get what he wants. And then, again, later on, everyone is there. Sean has gone off because Michael, the father, has just blessed Christie, the playboy, and Pickin's betrothal to hang with Sean. They are betrothed. This is a climax. He reached his highest point, we think. And as it happens, old Marn rushes in. And you realize that Marn has never been dead after all. Christie is mocked by Owen being a liar. In his anger, he picks up a lawyer, chases his father outside, and kills him again. The people are horrified because, as the king says, there's a great gap between a gallant story and a dirty deed. In other words, what they hear is fantastic, they just mustn't see reality. And then he's killed his father a second time. The others are implicated. He holds onto a table leg. And they wanted to take him to the police. He finds Sean's leg, and then the most horrible part, Begin burns his leg to make him let go. And he screams, because you're calling him up to the police, bring him out of my hand. And old man creeps in on all fours. The other shy away, and Christie, also on his knees, looks at his father and says, "I am coming to meet him for the third time, what ails him now?" And how does old man react? He's delighted because his son is basically saying, "I don't care what people think about me. I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm the boss now." And at long last, old man sees that his son is grown up. He's a real, real man. And they go out together. Christie leads the way. And Marn walks out. And he looks back at Christie. They don't lead the way. Oh, Christie sends it out first. And he looks at Christie and says, "Glory be to God, I am crazy again." In other words, glory be to God, I'm crazy. I know I'm mad. I've been hearing this story. This is wonderful, 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 wonderful. My son has made it. And Christie thanks everybody, everybody, for turning him into what he is, by listening to him, by letting him develop the story. And he says, "I'll go romancing through a romping lifetime. I'll go romancing, doesn't just mean I'll be filled with passion, but I'll be able to tell wonderful stories." Begin, however, puts a short over him and pleads, "Oh my grief, I've lost the only flavor of the Western world," which makes us realize there is tragedy in this as well. Because the king has got nothing at the end. Okay, it's pretty short KO, but there'll always be an anti-climax. We are going to make it over time. So, what are the comic elements in the story? First of all, it's comic because it's totally bizarre. It's comic because of the Irishism. It's comic because of the reverses in fortune all the time. It's also comic because we learn what women want. The 90s, 10 again. They want bravery, They want somebody to tell a good story. They want security. And they want a lover. We have irony throughout. We have different perspectives. We see things in a different light. By the way, there's an Afrikaans translation of this by André Grimm called Wurlas van Ubuntu, except in the colored area some years ago. Anyone ever see it? It's wonderful. Okay. We see the development of character. The language is so funny. We have wit and banter throughout. There's a physical action, slapstick. We've got that. We've got a mixture here. Not only of slapstick and fart, but of lyricism. And all this together adds to the humor of this quite marvelous play. To sum, I read the following in the Daily Maverick this past Thursday, 6 days ago. A study has just been published in the British Journal of Psychiatry. One of the authors, Gordon Claridge, a professor of psychiatry at Oxford, said, the creative elements needed to produce humor are strikingly similar to those characterizing the cognitive style of people with psychosis, both schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. I'm not surprised, I would have expected that. Even though the researchers are referring to comedians here, this could tie up with writers generally, and in particular, and in this context, to those who write comic narrative, poetry, novels, and plays. Those who find humor in certain events and convey them to us to make us laugh. We must often suspend our disbelief as to the reality of the situation. But sometimes the imaginative, Sissy Duke, the creative, Christy Mann, brings home to us what the truth is of the human condition. In taking us away from reality, think of all the texts we've looked at, writers just might make us understand reality a little better. They'll give us greater insight into who we are, who our neighbors are, what makes up society, with all our foibles and our failings, our jealousies, and our joys. And that in turn can lead us to greater understanding and be more tolerant of others. From my own experience, I realize that writers can have a split personality at times. Because I'm not alone here, we get so involved with our characters and their situations that they become real to us. So, to be honest about this, it must just take a little bit of madness to make people laugh. And then we all have some degree of that madness. I hope that you enjoy and you learn from this mad journey with me to works by the fantastic Chaucer and, of course, the coarser Chaucer, the diverse pickings from the distinctive and dazzling Dickens, and the singing of the superb, stupendous, and scintillating Synge. May you never look at Miller's Priests and Chickens in the same way again. May we never fail to remember that those who dictate in educational bigotry, they should be given hard times. That we must stand up against those who find humor in the misery of others, and that we can cry over expiring frogs. May we all see through stories which are embellished, but enjoy them anyway for what they are. And encourage those who are wimps to learn how to play in the world with all this in mind. And with all of us understanding the context, May we all be able to exult like old man at the end of labor of the Western world. Glory be to God.